Hi, this is John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center. Thanks so much for being a faithful listener to the Breakpoint Podcast. Each and every day, we strive to bring to you content that helps you make sense of what is at times a really confusing culture. If you find benefit in the daily Breakpoint commentaries and in the longer form content that we bring you three times a week right here on the Breakpoint Podcast, would you consider supporting this ministry? We can only do what we do because of the generous and faithful support of listeners like you. And so if this is a blessing to you, to your walk with the Lord, to your engagement with culture, and to your family, please consider supporting the Colson Center by giving a financial gift, especially at this time as we are coming up against the end of our fiscal year. Just visit breakpoint.org and click on the button that says give. That's breakpoint.org and click on give to support this ministry. Thank you very much and enjoy the podcast.
I want to jump right to the topic of Jack Phillips. We have been talking about this for months at the Colson Center. We kind of staked our claim that this was a biggie. This was no small case. This was going to be a defining case going forward, particularly, I think, if there was a loss. Do you think we overstated that? Could you maybe speak to how important the Jack Phillips case is kind of in the larger context of religious liberty, America, LGBT rights, and the place of people of faith?
Certainly, I'd be happy to do that, John. First, let me say how much I appreciate the opportunity to be back with you on this broadcast. I also want to take this occasion to say just how much I miss Chuck Colson. Chuck was a very, very dear friend and really something of a mentor to me. We worked so closely together over so many years, culminating in our work together on the Manhattan Declaration and on the video project, Doing the Right Thing, which was the last project on which Chuck and I worked together. We had a number of other wonderful people, Britt Hume and others, involved in that project. So I miss him. I still, these years later, have difficulty reconciling myself to his not being here. Sometimes it'll occur to me to reach for the telephone as if I could just type in his number and get him on the phone and ask for his advice or kick around some ideas with him. But you're doing a great job doing what he used to do on these kinds of broadcasts, and you work at the Colson Center, and I commend you for it. I commend Warren and everybody who's involved in the project. You're carrying on the work and building on the legacy of a great, very great man, and doing it very, very well indeed. So, Masterpiece Bake Shop, Jack Phillips. Let's begin by talking about who Jack is. I know many people who will be listening to this know the basic facts, but there's no harm in rehearsing them because the facts here are important. The decision turned pretty closely on the facts in this case. I'll go on in a few minutes to explain that the court did not resolve this as a broad matter of principle, which means that there are going to be more cases down the line, and the court will probably incrementally, gradually put a set of principles into place. In this particular case, the court resolved it somewhat narrowly and on the facts. So the question is, what are these facts? Jack Phillips is a Christian man. He's also a cake designer. He's not just a guy who bakes cakes and puts them out there on the shelf to sell. He's an artist. He's a cake artist. He's a creative person, the way a photographer or someone who does portrait painting or provides music is an artist, a creative person. He offers his creative talents to people who would like to take advantage of those talents. And he offers them for causes that he personally finds consistent with his Christian faith and will not offer those talents for causes that are inconsistent with his Christian faith, causes that he thinks are sinful. And so, for example, if you come into Jack Phillips' shop and you want to buy a cupcake, he's not going to ask you whether you have committed adultery or whether you have stolen or lied or cheated. He's not going to ask you anything about what your desires or inclinations, sexual or otherwise, are. He's going to sell you a cupcake. But if you come in and ask him, no matter who you are, no matter what your desires or inclinations are, no matter what your faith is or anything else about you, to design a cake to celebrate your divorce from a wife that you have come to loathe, Jack's not going to bake you that cake. He's not going to put his creative talents to work in celebrating a divorce because he doesn't believe in divorce. He believes what Jesus taught about divorce. So that's just a no-go. It's not prejudice. It's not bias on Jack's part. It's that he's not going to permit his creative talents to be deployed in causes that he thinks are antithetical to the gospel and to the will of God. Similarly, if you come in and ask for a Halloween cake, Christians have different opinions about Halloween. Jack is one of those Christians who believes that Halloween is really a celebration of a kind of paganism that's inconsistent with the gospel. It's not just innocent fun. So Jack will not sell you a Halloween celebration cake or other item designed to celebrate Halloween. He just won't. And he's not going to ask you whether you're Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or a neo-pagan of some sort or New Age or anything like Scientology. He's not going to ask anything about that. If the point of the cake is to celebrate Halloween, he's not going to sell it to you. Same thing when it comes to same-sex celebrations. He's not going to ask you, what are your sexual inclinations? Are you inclined to people of the same sex or anything like that? He's just not going to bake a cake for a same-sex celebration because same-sex marriage is, in his judgment and in mine, contrary. It's an incoherent idea, same-sex marriage. It's contrary to the gospel understanding, the biblical understanding, and I would add the natural law and classical understanding of marriage as the conjugal union of husband and wife. It's not something else. So if two people that's of the same sex come in, and even if they make plain that they are in some sort of same-sex relationship, if they ask Jack to bake them a cake to celebrate a promotion at work, he'll bake the cake. He's not going to say, are you gay? Are you homosexual? He's going to bake you the cake. If you say, look, I'm Bill, and it's Joe here's birthday coming up on Saturday, and I want to buy a birthday cake for him. Jack's going to bake that birthday cake because there's nothing wrong with birthdays and celebrating birthdays. But if you come in and say, I'm Joe and this is Jack, this is Bill, and we're going to be having a same-sex wedding or so-called wedding, and we'd like you to bake a cake, he's going to say exactly what he would say if you ask him to bake a Halloween cake or a cake to celebrate a divorce, and that is, I'm sorry, I can't bake that. Can't put my creative designing talent to use, my God-given creative designing talent to use to celebrate that because that's contrary to the gospel. Now Jack's not going to insult you. He's not going to give you a lecture. He's not going to pretend that he's in the pulpit and it's Sunday and give a sinners in the hands of an angry God sermon. He's just going to politely decline to bake you a cake. Now, if you are that same-sex pair, there are dozens of shops in Denver and the area that will make a cake to celebrate your partnership. You don't need Jack Phillips to bake you a cake. But activists in that movement want to make sure that nobody can dissent from it in any kind of effective way. So they want to force Jack Phillips and any other Christian or Orthodox Jew or Muslim or other person who believes that marriage is the conjugal union of husband and wife. They want to force you to go along with that, at least in the business end of things, on pain of being fined, although a fine in the end was not what was at stake at this case, being sent to re-education camp, so-called counseling, being subjected to some punishment for not going along. And the clear goal is to stigmatize and marginalize those of us who cling to the classical and natural law and biblical understanding of marriage and marginalize us. And that is where the court stepped in. When the Colorado Civil Rights Commission ruled against Jack in a ruling that was then upheld in the Colorado courts, Jack took it to the Supreme Court that agreed to hear the case. The technical term for that is granted certiorari. And who then ruled by a 7-2 majority. It wasn't 5-4. It wasn't one of these narrow, close cases in terms of the vote. By 7-2 ruled that because the Colorado Civil Rights Commission was motivated by animus or hostility to Jack's beliefs about marriage, his religiously informed beliefs about marriage, they cannot constitutionally impose a punishment on him. Now, the next question, of course, John, is, well, what was the evidence that they were motivated by hostility? Why? How did the justices in the majority know that the motivation here was an illicit motivation? That
well, it wasn't religiously pretty obvious in this case, didn't it?
No, they did. That what happened is, I mean, the record was simply filled with statements by members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission expressing really what amounts to contempt for Christians and their beliefs about morality, and especially about marriage and sexual morality. So the court ruled on the basis of those statements that the First Amendment guarantee of the free exercise of religion was violated because the Colorado Commission did not proceed in a religiously neutral way in reaching a result in the matter of Jack Phillips. So here's, I think, the takeaway. We should applaud the outcome. The outcome is correct. That's number one. Number two, it would have been a disaster for religious freedom had Jack Phillips lost this case.
Well, let me jump in if I can, Professor George, because that's what we're hearing, two sides. You know, one side, you know, couldn't be quick enough to say this was a big win, this was a huge win. We use that language, and I can give our reason for that. And then another group looked at it and said, this is narrow, it's nothing, it doesn't really solve the problem. My argument was, this was a big win, if for no other reason than a loss would have been catastrophic.
That's what you mean by a big win. That's right. I mean, certainly it's true. A loss would have been catastrophic. It would have licensed activity by governmental agencies motivated by anti-Christian bigotry. And there couldn't be anything worse for the First Amendment than that. But I would urge you to step back a little bit from the language of big win. A catastrophe was avoided. And we did get a win. I wouldn't say it was a big win. I would say it was a little but not insignificant win. And we did avert a catastrophe. Now, that gets us to the next steps I wanted to take us on.
Yeah.
What's the scope of the ruling? The reason I'm saying it's not a big win, although a catastrophe was avoided, is that the scope of the ruling itself is indeterminate. That's what I meant when I said at the beginning that the court seems to be moving incrementally rather than putting a comprehensive set of principles into place. That's why we will get future cases. Had the court ruled in the way I would have preferred, which was really in the way that Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas would have ruled, then the principles would all be in place. No more cases would come to the Supreme Court because the lower courts would then be forced to handle all these cases in a way that was respectful of religious liberty, and we'd be golden. But a majority couldn't be put together. A majority of five couldn't be put together for a broad and principled ruling like that. So we got a somewhat narrow ruling. The vote wasn't narrow. That was 7-2. That was good. But the scope of the ruling is somewhat indeterminate. The court is moving incrementally. Now, basically, there are two schools of thought on the court competing to establish the scope of religious liberty in this area. And you see it in the concurring opinions. A concurring opinion is where a justice agrees with the result and with some of the reasoning in the opinion, but writes separately to give a different take or a supplemental take on that result and why it was reached and what it all means. The two liberal justices, Justices Kagan and Breyer, who joined in the majority to make it 7-2, issued a concurrence written by Kagan, joined by Breyer, both of whom, by the way, are friends of mine and people I respect. They're on the opposite side. Here they joined the majority, but contributed a concurrence which tries to narrow the ruling, to restrict its significance, and limit the scope of the religious liberty that it vindicates. they pretty much wanted to narrow it to the facts of this case, that is, to facts in which you've got more or less overt or clear, somehow evident, bigotry or animus motivating the governmental body or agency that limits the religious liberty of the claimant, the religious liberty claimant, in this case, Jack Phillips. That's way too narrow. That's way too narrow. And we do not want that to be the direction the law goes in. Rather, we want the broad and fulsome understanding of religious liberty that you find defended and vied for, advocated in two separate concurrences. One by Justice Neil Gorsuch, joined by Justice Sam Alito, and then a separate one by Justice Clarence Thomas. Now, let me tell you about those two opinions. Justice Gorsuch's opinion takes on directly and contests the narrow Kagan-Breyer reading. It does conceive the case fundamentally as a free exercise of religion case, but wants a broader understanding of free exercise of religion than what Kagan and Breyer want. A ruling of the sort Gorsuch would prefer, and what he will no doubt advocate for down the line in future cases, would not require that there be any open or overt expressions of bigotry, an anti-Christian or anti-religious animus on the part of a government agency in order to vindicate a free exercise claim by a claimant against whom the agency is acting. All you would need is some evidence that the agency wasn't treating the religious liberty claimant fairly, like the evidence that you actually have in this case, in which the Colorado Civil Rights Commission came down like a ton of bricks on Jack Phillips because he would not bake a cake for a same-sex wedding, and yet ruled in favor of secular liberal bakers, or I don't know if they were secular, but liberal progressive bakers, who refused to bake cakes at the requests of religious people who wanted cakes that expressed anti-same-sex marriage sentiments. You see what I mean? So I don't know what the exact details of the case were, but let me give you something undoubtedly very close to what was done here. So a Christian comes in and says, look, I want you to bake me a cake for an event I'm doing against redefining marriage to extend it to same-sex partners, changing the meaning of it. I want you to depict on the cake two men and a plus sign between the two of them with an X through the plus sign to indicate that two men really cannot be truly married. So the Christian comes in, asks for the cake. The baker says, no, I'm not going to bake you that cake. I'm for same-sex marriage, or I'm against, I think that's insulting to gay people. So the Colorado Commission thinks that's a perfectly legitimate exercise of the religious liberty of the secular liberal baker, but reaches a different conclusion in the case of the Christian baker, who says, well, look, I don't want to create a pro-same-sex marriage case. Now, Kagan and Breyer labor very hard to distinguish those cases, but for reasons that Gorsuch makes very clear, does a tremendous job, actually. The concurrence is a joy to read. He demolishes the Kagan argument. The Kagan argument is quite rhetorically clever, actually, when you see it. I urge your listeners to go and have a look at it. But then also look at the Gorsuch opinion, which quite masterfully dismantles it. Now, how about the
Just before you jump off that topic, I ran into the man who went around Denver asking these bakers to bake these anti-gay marriage cakes just this past weekend in Richmond. He's a friend here who lives in Colorado. Funny thing, when I heard the story that somebody did that, I thought, I bet that's Bill Jack. And it was Bill Jack. It was the guy.
That's right. The name is Jack. I remember it from the case, actually.
Yeah.
I met him, of course.
You know, this is a side point, but one of the things that that Chuck really believed in is that everyday Christians needed to jump in. They can't stay out of cultural engagement. They've got to show action and courage. And I think this case, and I don't want to derail the legal analysis too quickly here, but this case shows two cases of that. One is the morning after that story hit in the Colorado newspaper that Jack Phillips refused this to this business. A lawyer who had just been to an ADF training event the week before drove across town with a business card and gave it to Jack and said, "You might need these guys." And she was encouraged at the end of that week-long training, and you've been there to the ADF summit, as have I. They said, "Do the next thing." And that morning, she heard the story, drove across town, and did the next thing. Bill Jack told me on Saturday, as we were catching up, and I said, "You were named in three opinions, you know, as an example of this. And right. What you did really mattered." And he said, "John, I waited for a month to see if somebody would do it. And no one did it. And I went to my wife and she said, 'Are you sure you want to do this?'" And he did it. Well, and both what great examples of Christians just doing something, jump in. And I think that's a lesson for all of us.
It absolutely is. I had occasion this week to give a commencement address on the exact date, 40 years later, the 40th anniversary to the very day of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's famous commencement address at Harvard, where, as I recalled to the young people I was speaking with, where Solzhenitsyn warned us, warned the West, warned America, that we were failing in our spiritual and moral lives because we had lost courage. The problem is not just that there are people who have gone in an immoral direction, believe immoral things, have embraced immoral causes. It's that people who have not embraced immoral causes, have not gone off in immoral directions, but who lack the courage to speak up for what's right, to distinguish what's right from what's wrong, and to stand up and say, "Look, we need to do what's right in this country, and we need to avoid what's doing wrong." It's that courageous Christian witness that Solzhenitsyn himself embodied that we are missing. Solzhenitsyn told us 40 years ago we're missing it. And we're missing it today. And many of the losses that we have incurred, including on the marriage issue, on the substance of the question of what marriage is, we've lost, I think not forever, but for the time being, we have lost because of a lack of courage. People on the other side, on the pro same-sex marriage side, were more courageous, more willing to fight for what they believed in than we were prepared to fight for the great godly institution of marriage. There is a huge price to be paid for any culture that loses its courage. And that's not just for Christian leaders. They have an important role to play. That's for everyday Christians, the man and woman in the pew. All of us are called to discipleship. All of us are called by the Great Commission. All of us are called to speak truth in love to power. There's nobody who should say, "Well, I'm just a little person. I have no influence." You can do the kinds of things that Mr. Jack did. You can do the kinds of things that a lot of people did finally come around to doing when Jack Phillips himself had the courage to stand up for his Christian faith and bear witness.
Let me ask you a question came in from Carol, and I want to answer it. She said, "If I were Jack Phillips, given the narrow scope of the ruling, that I would decide not to go back into making wedding cakes." And it's quite, I mean, many people have pointed out with the decision, he could be sued again tomorrow. And if the Colorado Civil Rights Commission were nicer, it may not go the way we want it. What do you think about that? Should he jump out of the, I think he announced that he is baking wedding cakes again. What do you think he should do?
Of course he's baking wedding cakes again. And it's not just because he loves what he does. And it's not just to make money. I'll tell you why Jack Phillips is going to bake cakes again, because he has the courage. He knows he's called to bear witness today. He has the courage that Solzhenitsyn found missing in so many of us 40 years ago, and which is still missing in so many of us today. You know, we're just as happy to get on with our lives and, you know, have our rights even restricted and just stay out of trouble. God didn't call us to stay out of trouble. What did Jesus tell us? What did Jesus tell us to expect if we want to be his disciples? A cross. Take up your cross and follow me. It's going to come with suffering. It's going to come with anxiety. It's going to come sometimes with terror and fear. But that's what we're called to do. We're not called to just get by. Okay, they don't want us in the baking business. We'll get out of the baking business. We'll go into something else. We'll stay out of trouble. No, our job's not to stay out of trouble. Our job is to stand and bear faithful witness. And that's what Jack Phillips is going to do, because that's Jack Phillips. But, you know, there's nothing special about Jack Phillips. The same demand of the gospel is made on Robert George and John Stone Street and anybody else, any Christian in the pews.
Let me ask you a question about Justice Kennedy, going back to the legal side of things. Otherwise, we just need to have an altar call and invite everyone to come forward.
Yeah.
A wonderful challenge. And it's exactly, I think, what this case can teach every one of us. It's hard to imagine what's going to happen in the future. But of course, there's rumors about Justice Kennedy wanting this to be his kind of final swan song, his, you know, his final contribution to balance out the LGBT religious freedom conflict that he kind of created with Obergefell and the one before that, I'm blanking out on the name of before Obergefell, Windsor. But it seems like the thing we have heard from him most over the last several years is that he is against animus. He has an animus against animus. And if there's, I mean, this is the thing that keeps coming up. It was anybody who's not on board with same-sex marriage reveals that they have an animus. And now the Civil Rights Commission was wrong because they expressed animus. Is there more in this legacy that we're going to get? And do you want to make any prediction about whether he's going to retire now? Any ideas?
I have no idea. I know him slightly. I don't know him nearly as well as I know a number of other justices on the court, including Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer. I saw him at the Neil Gorsuch investiture. I was there as Justice Gorsuch's guest, and Justice Kennedy was there. So was Justice Ginsburg and Justice Alito and the other justices. Justice Kennedy is getting older. He's now over 80, but he seemed to be in reasonably good health. So did Justice Ginsburg. I don't imagine that either one of them is going to be eager to step away from the court right now, especially since in both cases, they would likely be replaced by a justice, given President Trump's record in appointing justices, a justice who would not rule in ways consistent with their legacy and with what they would prefer. So I'd be surprised, unless there's a health issue that I don't know about, that Justice Kennedy retires. But I don't know. Who knows? I mean, I think anybody who claims to know outside the Kennedy family, and maybe even within the Kennedy family, actually doesn't know. I do want to say a word, though, about Justice Thomas's concurrence, because it's really important. Can I do that? Yeah. So I mentioned the Gorsuch concurrence, which is really strictly concerned with the free exercise of religion question. But there's another very important issue in this case. And it's an issue on which the amicus curiae brief, friend of the court brief that I myself joined in the case, was focused on. And that is the free speech issue. This is not just a free exercise of religion case. It's also a free speech case. And those two freedoms in a case like this, and the cases that are coming up behind it, coming through the system, are really closely connected. And Justice Thomas's opinion really focuses in on the free speech dimension of the case. Now, let me briefly explain, John. The Supreme Court has for many decades, beginning in 1943, in a case involving Jehovah's Witness children who refused to salute the flag because it was against their conscientious beliefs and their interpretation of the Bible. The court has ruled going all the way back to 1943, that the protection of the freedom of speech includes the protection of the freedom not to speak. That is, the freedom not to be compelled by the government to say things that you yourself do not believe or approve of. Now, it's true that the government can, under some circumstances, force you to speak. For example, it can subpoena you as a witness and require you to say what you saw at the intersection you were standing near when the accident happened or something like that, or what you saw when someone held up a grocery store or whatever. What the government cannot do is force you to say things that you don't believe, or force you to say things that you don't approve of. That's part of the freedom of speech. And Jack Phillips made the point that he is being compelled here to make a cake whose expressive content is approval of same-sex marriage. And that's a violation of his right not to speak, not to say things or express ideas that are contrary to his beliefs. Justice Thomas was the sole justice who picked up on that and really made it central to his particular treatment of the case in his concurring opinion. In future cases, I predict that the court is going to have to face up to that. The other justices basically said nothing about it, pro or con. They're going to have to deal with it. And I hope with all my heart, because I think this is a very powerful and important argument, I really hope that the justices will see that it cannot be squared with the constitutional guarantee of free speech for government agencies to compel people to engage in expressive conduct that they disapprove of the content of the expression on. So let's keep our eyes open as other cases involving florists and wedding planners and singers and all sorts of things, the wedding industry, come up before the court. Also have in mind that these cases are of relevance not just to issues of same-sex marriage or homosexuality or anything like that. They also pertain to other areas. For example, whether people can be compelled to participate in abortions or to refer for abortions. We've got a case that's going to be, we're going to get a decision from the court on any day coming up out of California involving an effort by the state there to compel pro-life pregnancy centers to essentially advertise the availability of abortion services. That again is kind of compelled speech. So there's pretty much the outline. There were two dissents that were written by the most extreme members of the court's left wing. It was one dissent in which the two joined, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor. And essentially, they argued that any animus that might have been expressed against Jack Phillips's Christianity or his moral beliefs was just irrelevant, that the Colorado law trumped any concerns there, and that Jack Phillips should be punished or driven out of business. It's kind of a frightening view. It's hard for me to believe that you could have sitting members of the Supreme Court who really would go that far. Certainly Kagan and Breyer wouldn't go that far. But there it is. Fortunately, it's a small minority. It's just two.
Well, it was a stunning decision on the other side, the dissent. How does that come out process-wise? Does a dissent come out after the majority has voted? I mean, do you think because Kennedy landed where he landed and there were seven, that made that opinion more extreme, or would that have been written separately? Could you talk a little bit about how the process works?
Sure. The court decides whether to take a case. Now, in the old days, there was a lot more mandatory cases than you have today. Today, it's very rare that the court faces a case where it's required actually to take it on appeal or on certiorari. These days, for all intents and purposes or minor exceptions, the court's jurisdiction is discretionary. It can decide to take a case or to just leave things where they stand in the lower courts, even if the lower courts are in conflict and the law is in effect being treated differently in different parts of the country. So first it decides whether to take a case. Takes very few these days, I think 70 or 80 at most. And it usually just takes cases that are in important areas where the law needs to be clarified or settled. Then briefs are submitted. The briefs of the parties, these are written submissions making arguments on the competing sides. And then something I mentioned earlier, amicus curiae briefs. Amicus curiae is just Latin for friend of the court. These are people who have an interest in the case, organizations, it could be the U.S. government, if the government's not a party, who have an interest in the case, they want to be heard, the court permits them ordinarily to submit a brief and make whatever arguments they want. Once the briefs are in, the court, the justices read them, and then there's a conference day. And a discussion is scheduled for this case for that conference day. And I worked for Chief Justice Rehnquist. My sense, although we weren't allowed and no one was allowed in the conference room except the justices, my sense from him as to how it worked was, Chief Justice will try to get an initial sense of where people are on the case, which direction they're leaning in. Then they go around the table and they discuss it. Each gives a sense of where he or she is, says why. Then they have some argument. Either minds are changed or minds aren't changed in the argument. Then it goes to oral argument. I might have that confused. Actually, I'm now thinking that the conference comes after the oral argument. So after the briefs are read and considered, there's oral argument, then the conference, and then a vote is taken. If the Chief Justice assigns the opinion for the majority, if he's in the majority, he can assign it to himself if he wants to, or assign it to one of the other justices. Since Chief Justice Roberts in the Jack Phillips Masterpiece Bakery case was in the majority, he did the assigning of the majority opinion. He assigned it to Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy wrote it. Most of the other justices joined it. Two justices dissented. Justice Thomas concurred in the judgment, but not in the opinion, and wrote his own separate concurring opinion. Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Alito, joined in the opinion, but also added stuff in a concurring opinion, as did Justices Kagan. Justice Kagan, joined by Justice Breyer. There's some back and forth where the opinions are circulated, and they can address each other in footnotes, and that happened in this case. There's a footnote in the Kagan opinion addressing some arguments Gorsuch is making in his opinion, and Gorsuch is clearly in the text of his opinion. He's clearly revised to answer in the text of his concurring opinion what Kagan, joined by Breyer, had said in that footnote. The real action in this case, most of the action in this case, is in the argument between Gorsuch and Kagan, even though they're both on the same side on the outcome. But the real argument is there, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, that was a fascinating back and forth. And again, I'm grateful that you encouraged everyone to read the opinions. They're available. You should read them on a case like this. This is just really important. We've got a couple other questions coming in. You already kind of spoke to that this will affect, you know, the Baronel Stutzman case. You know, you've got the Sweet Cakes by Melissa in Oregon. There are other cases. I know Phoenix, the city of Phoenix just won in the case against the calligraphers, I believe, not in a Supreme Court case, but
that'll be appealed, actually.
That'll be appealed, yeah. So
by the state.
Was this judgment so narrowly stuck with Jack Phillips? Do you think the court is, I know they're considering picking up the Baronel case for next term. Is that likely? You think they're going to pick that up?
I do.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be incremental, case by case, as they fashion a set of principles that they think do justice to all the competing concerns. It's not the way I would prefer to do it. It's not the way Justice Gorsuch would prefer to do it. It's not the way Justice Thomas would prefer to do it. But it looks like that's the way the court's going.
Well, it's going to just be, I think it underscores the importance of the body of Christ supporting these people. I mean, you know, for Jack Phillips, this was a 4 or 5 year process. For Baronel, it's gone on for years. Yep. For Melissa Klein, it's gone on for years. One of the things the church is going to have to reckon with is how do we support these people who are being courageous?
Absolutely.
For a 7 year hell, essentially.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to begin by praying for those people every day. They are heroes. They are people who are courageously bearing witness to the truths of the gospel about the nature of marriage as the conjugal union of husband and wife, about sexual morality. There are others who are standing up for the pro-life cause. We need to emulate them. But before anything else, we need to remember them in prayer. We need to provide prayer support. Also be in touch with them. Go if you're in the area, visit them. Buy some flowers. Buy some cupcakes. Support them in that way. Write them a note. Go online and defend them when they're being vilified and attacked by people who misguidedly think of them as bigots or bad people. They're the very opposite. I mean, these are people who love everybody, and they just want to spread Jesus's love and message of the life-giving, liberating quality of morally upright living. That's basically what they are trying to do. And how are they compensated for that? By vilification, by having their businesses put at risk, by being threatened with fines, and even in some cases jail, and and being sent to re-education training sessions and things like this. They need us. They deserve our prayers and support.
You know, I was grateful. I don't know if you heard Professor George, but on Friday, this past Friday, a group called the Gay Army had scheduled a protest outside of Jack's shop, and ADF called, and I was traveling and I couldn't get there, but we kind of rallied a bunch of folks here across Colorado to show up. A thousand committed to protest. And so we had a couple hundred there. Only 12 protesters showed up, which was, and they were drowned out by a bunch of people who lined up to buy all the cupcakes that Jack Phillips had in the store. So it was that was good news of people kind of supporting them. But I agree. I mean, Jack is one of the kindest men. He's just a man of character. He's just solid. You know, I don't agree with his take on Halloween, but that's okay. He's kind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Here's another question that came in. And I remember Chuck saying this as well, but Paul from South Carolina is asking. And I remember when Chuck said, hey, Supreme Court justices read the newspapers too. And that, you know, we kind of see them as kind of sequestered and they don't listen to any of us. And so it really doesn't matter once it's in the hands of the justices. We don't have any influence. Chuck once said, and I remember this, write letters to the editor, you know, talk out loud, create this kind of cultural conversation, because the justices are people too. And they're listening for where the culture, you know, is. Do you think that's an accurate reflection, or would you disagree with that?
No question about it. I mean, I know these people. I know most of them, and several of them are friends of mine. And they try to do a very good job. They try to be objective. They try not to be influenced by public opinion. But they're people too, as you say, and they're influenced by the culture. I can tell you something with a high degree of confidence. Obergefell, the ruling in which the Supreme Court just invented out of whole cloth a right to same-sex marriage. It's terrible jurisprudence, just regardless of what you think of same-sex marriage, whether you're for it or against it. I mean, I'm against the concept, but lay that aside, just as a jurisprudential matter, imagining that that is a constitutional requirement is just nuts. But anyway, there we are. We would not have gotten that had we continued the string of victories in marriage referenda around the country that got to 32 when in 2012, because of a lack of money, because our people did not contribute money to support the pro-marriage side in the referenda in states like Washington State and I think Maryland that day, and Maine, and I think it might have been Minnesota, I'm not sure. So we got a set of defeats for the first time. And it was those defeats that emboldened Anthony Kennedy to say, now's the time we can pull the trigger. The culture is ready for us to declare a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. Had we done our job, had we equipped our brave people in those states fighting for marriage with the financial resources to win those marriage referenda, the Supreme Court would not have handed down that opinion. They would not have handed down an opinion creating a constitutional right to same-sex marriage in the face of an unbroken 36-0 string of referenda victories, where the people of the United States had spoken clearly about what they believe marriage to be. So it can really, really make a difference. And in those cases, you know, it's not as if we needed as much money as the other side had. We could be outspent 2-1, 3-1, and still prevail. We had done that in other states. The other side has more money. They've got elite support, the powerful, the wealthy, the elite sector of the culture is pretty much behind them. But we were able to win if we could keep it our disadvantage down to 2-1 or 3-1. It starts getting to be more than that, and you just can't win. And as a result of that, we lost. Those were unnecessary losses. They shouldn't have happened. And they put Anthony Kennedy in the position to pull the trigger and create out of whole cloth, manufacture this so-called constitutional right to same-sex marriage. It was a great tragedy for which we bear some responsibility for allowing those losses in those referenda, because we didn't self-sacrificially support our side.
Well, given that mood that Justice Kennedy seized upon, believing that you know, the time was right. I mean, I don't want to say it's only
that's
gotten
speculation, worse, but I'm quite confident about it.
Yeah. Well, it's only gotten worse since then in terms of public opinion polls and things like that. So as you're looking in your crystal ball and saying, okay, let's say the court picks up Baronel Stutzman's case for the next term. And I mean, there's some animus, I think, in the way the state of Washington has treated her, and it might be incremental. You know, as you said, I mean, you have a fear that this is then going to be, okay, well, Kennedy bought a year, kind of like what he did with Windsor. And what we're going to get now is the sweeping defeat. I mean, I hate to be that voice, but do we, you know,
it's a legitimate worry. It's a legitimate worry. And that's why we need to make our voices heard. We really do. I mean, that's your point, right? Your point is that Supreme Court justices are like other people. They take a sounding, a reading of the culture. I think Kennedy did that, and that's what produced Obergefell after the losses in the referenda. So we need to make sure that the justices of the Supreme Court know that there are still millions of Americans who are pro-marriage, and many even more who are pro-religious liberty, and that we will regard it as a great offense against our constitutional principles for them to rule against somebody like Baronel Stutzman. So we, you know, we just have to keep the heat up. I mean, write letters, post stuff online, write letters to the editor, support candidates who are pro-religious liberty. Just fight in any place you can, in any domain, doing anything you can, and start it all with prayer. Start and end it all with prayer to hold up our side here. That's really what we need.
One of the things I appreciated, Professor, at the beginning is you took such care to lay out here's exactly what happened. And we've got a break point specifically on what we call the zombie myths about Jack Phillips. It's these things, you know, he doesn't serve gay people. Jesus would have baked the cake. I mean, these things that you hear over and over and over that just won't die. And I'm especially grieved when I hear them from Christians. I had somebody, you know, tweet in response to me this morning, Jesus would have baked the cake. I mean, what does that mean? And so we're dealing with these things. I appreciated the level of clarity that you brought. And I think in addition to prayer, we've got to start with clarity. We've got to start and say, this is not what happened. This is what happened. And if Jesus would have baked the cake, that's not the point. Religious freedom is about not what you think Jesus would have done, but what Jack thinks Jesus would have done. And then what? And so.
But you know, if we're going to get into the issue of what Jesus would have done, can we be serious about this and not fool around? You know, Jesus is the guy who drove the money changers out of the temple with a whip. No, I don't want anybody to go with any whips after anybody. Don't follow Jesus quite that closely. But Jesus was not, you know, like soft on immorality. Now, let's go to the marriage issue. People come up to Jesus and say, hey, you know, Moses permitted divorce. What do you say? Now, this phony Jesus that people have cooked up these days would have said, well, you know, couples, sometimes things just break down and they fall out of love and things go wrong. And gee, it's hard on people. And, you know, they really got to get on with their life. And, you know, you don't want people to be lonely. You don't want people to be unhappy. So, yeah, you know, Moses was right. And maybe Moses made it a little even too hard. And maybe we need to be more understanding. And maybe we need to, you know, just facilitate, make divorce as easy and painless as we possibly can because of all that these people are going through. I mean, can't we just be nice? But that's not the real Jesus. That's not the man, right? That's not the Son of God. That's not the eternal second person of the Blessed Trinity. His answer is radically different. Yeah, Moses told you that. Moses permitted divorce. That's because of the hardness of your hearts. I, Jesus, say to you, he who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. That's a tough line. This is not a guy who goes around baking cakes to celebrate stuff he thinks is wrong. Can we just be clear about that since we're going for clarity?
Well, let's do that. I in fact, Bill Jack, the guy who went around, you know, asking for the anti-gay cakes, he, you know, we were having this conversation on Saturday as well, and I thought he gave a great analogy. And I love your line about, yeah, the phony Jesus would have baked the cake, but not the not the real Jesus. We got to say that. But Bill Jack, he says he often replies and says, well, we don't know. You know, Jesus wasn't a baker, but he was a carpenter. Do we think that Jesus would have made the wedding bed, you know, for the same sex wedding?
And probably not. I thought,
probably not. No, I think that's right.
The money changers out of the temple and takes a line much harder than Moses on divorce. That's not the guy who goes making wedding beds for.
No, that's right.
Contrary to them.
Bill asks, and we've listed some of these. You've mentioned the NIFLA case, which we're waiting for a decision on any moment. That's when California tried to co-opt pregnancy care centers to be their advertisers. We mentioned the Baranel-Stutzman case, which is the one right now that probably will be picked up by the Supreme Court as the kind of part two. Are there other cases that you would say, hey, pay attention to this one, pay attention to that one?
I don't know where the Kelvin Cochran case is. Now, he is the fire chief of Atlanta who was fired by the mayor. Kelvin Cochran was an amazing story. He grew up in segregated Louisiana. He saw a fire truck and a fire crew putting out a fire when he was a boy, and he decided that that was going to be his vocation. He was going to be a firefighter. And lots of us, when we're little boys, think we're going to be firefighters. He stayed with it, and he became a wonderful firefighter. And Rose, I think, became fire chief in Shreveport, I think, and then moved up to being fire chief in Atlanta. Perfectly great at his job. No one ever questioned that he was a wonderful fire chief. But he writes a book about biblical morality, including the biblical prohibition of homosexuality, or homosexual conduct, for his church and for his friends and others with whom he was in relationships and friendships, trying to send this message. And he gets fired by the mayor for his Christian beliefs. That's an outrage. I mean, that's an assault on free speech. That's an assault on free exercise of religion. It seems to me that if anything's unconstitutional, that is unconstitutional. This guy who remembers all too well being victimized by the Jim Crow regime of segregation, now being victimized again with a different motivation and set of rights in play is free speech and freedom of religion rights. Now, I don't know where that case is now, but I would like to see that case eventually go to the Supreme Court of the United States, because I think we need some clarity from these justices about whether that kind of thing is going to be permitted, given our explicit constitutional protections for freedom of speech and the free exercise of religion. By the way, John, you know, a moment ago I forgot to say what happens when the Chief Justice is not in the majority. What happens to the opinion when the Chief Justice is in dissent after the initial vote. In that case, the senior most justice assigns the majority opinion. He can assign it to himself. So it's the senior most justice who is in the majority who assigns the opinion either to himself or to someone else who's in the majority. So just wanted to wrap that one up.
I agree. I'd love to see the Kelvin Cochran case get picked up. You know, we often made the, you know, Chuck often made that distinction between freedom of worship and freedom of religion. The idea that you could take your deeply held beliefs into the public square versus just having them to yourself. And the Kelvin Cochran case is really even a threat on a freedom of worship sort of idea. I mean, he didn't take
it. Yeah, sure. Yeah, he created the book, as I understand. I don't know all the details, but as I understand it, he created the book really for his church. Now, one good thing about the Kennedy opinion, it was in many ways not a great opinion, got the right outcome. The Kennedy opinion in the Masterpiece Cake Shop, the Jack Phillips case, he did explicitly repudiate. Kennedy repudiated the idea that religion can be restricted by the state to the private sphere. He absolutely explicitly said that is an incorrect understanding of the Constitution. On the contrary, the Constitution protects the right of the religious believer, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever you are, Sikh, Hindu, Buddhist, the right of the religious believer not only to worship in his church or pray at home, but to take his faith into the public square and advocate its teachings. It was very good. I was really glad to see that in a Supreme Court. It was overdue for the Supreme Court to actually say that, given how often we hear, even from people who claim to be constitutional authorities, how often we hear that, you know, religion under our Constitution is really a purely private matter. That's just not true. And the court has finally said, not true. On the contrary, the Constitution itself protects the right of the believer to enter the public square fully clothed in his faith, expressing and advocating his views.
Well, Professor, we're at the end of our hour. You've been great and answering an awful lot of questions. We have some more that we're not going to be able to get to. We're going to make this webinar available on our podcast, and it will air, I think, early next week. And I mentioned at that breakpoint where we clarify some of the zombie myths about the Jack Phillips case. It was going to air tomorrow. It's actually going to air on Monday as well. So I had the time right, and I was just corrected by our team here, which was great. But Professor, thanks for the clarity that you bring and the care of just kind of walking us through these things in the midst of all the noise and the hysteria. It's so helpful to stop and think, but then also to be called to action. And you did a great job, I think, calling us to say, look, this is not the time to step back and rest. The issue is just as hot as ever, and it's moving forward. And if we're not in the game, it's not going to end up like we want it to end up. So thanks for that clarity and that challenge. We're really grateful for you.
Well, thank you, John. And thanks again for the opportunity to be on the show. And God bless you and Warren and everybody else who's involved. Really love seeing the work that you're doing going forward, Chuck's legacy being carried on, and grateful for it.
This is Shane Morris. As John mentioned at the beginning of the show, we'd appreciate it if you would consider making a donation to the Ministry of Breakpoint during the month of June. All you need to do is go to breakpoint.org and click on Give. Thanks very much for listening and for your support.